This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks so much for tuning in today. More common than asthma and diabetes? Migraine. It is a neurological disease that afflicts more than 30 million Americans. That according to our guest this afternoon. She is a neurologist and a migraine sufferer. Her name is Dr. Carolyn Bernstein. Together with journalist Elaine McArdle, who also suffers from migraine, Dr. Bernstein is the author of The Migraine Brain, Your Breakthrough Guide to Fewer Headaches, Better Health. Dr. Bernstein says despite the number of people who suffer the excruciating pain of migraine, migraine is, in her words, one of the most misunderstood, misdiagnosed, and undertreated diseases on earth. And she says this is a disease that can ruin your life, making you so sick that you can't work, enjoy your family, read a book, or even hold your head up. Listeners, your questions about migraine are invited this afternoon. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Carolyn Bernstein, MD, is an assistant professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School and a staff neurologist at Cambridge Health Alliance in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She's also the founder and director of the Women's Headache Center at Cambridge Health Alliance, which opened in 2006. Her honors include the Harvard Medical School Faculty Prize for Teaching Excellence and the Leonard Toe Award for Humanism in Medicine, given by Harvard Medical School and the Arnold Gold Foundation. Dr. Bernstein's book, The Migraine Brain, Your Breakthrough Guide to Fewer Headaches, Better Health, is published by the Free Press. Again, our phone numbers, if you'd like to join us this afternoon, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Dr. Bernstein, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. So why has migraine been so misunderstood, misdiagnosed, and undertreated?
Well, I think that's a really complex question. I think that physicians are really refining their ability to make a careful and good diagnosis of this illness, of this process, and that affects our ability to treat patients properly and really understand them. So old thinking, it's just a headache, there's nothing you can do, here are some painkillers. That kind of treatment is really beginning to disappear as we understand that migraine is a physiologic, it's a pathophysiologic process. And what that means is that it's a sequence of events that are taking place in the brain that trigger off all the different things that migraine sufferers feel.
Now, this was really interesting. People who get migraines are at higher risk for other medical problems. Men are at higher risk for heart attack. Of people with migraine, 54% are also clinically depressed. So can diagnosis, treatment, and steps taken to prevent migraine, to lessen the effects of migraine, help head off those problems and others?
Well, again, just an excellent question and one that I always like to speak on because I think raising awareness is just so important. So with the careful and correct diagnosis of migraines, we can identify other risk factors. And I will tell you that a lot of patients who come in are worried about the connection between migraine and stroke. So what can we do to really prevent stroke when we identify somebody with a higher risk? And with certain kinds of migraines, indeed, it does look like your risk of stroke is a little bit higher. We can focus on preventive treatment as part of the visit, as part of the treatment, looking at your blood pressure, looking at your cholesterol, stopping smoking if that's an issue, all the different pieces that can raise somebody's risk of having a stroke. And likewise for the men who it looks like may actually have some kind of increased risk, although it's very small, of heart disease, we can identify and try to modify any risk factors that we can find. So that's a really wonderful chance to be proactive with someone's care. In terms of depression, I was talking about this with a colleague recently. It really is a which comes first question at this point. So are you depressed because you feel so sick and you have migraines so much of the time, or do the migraines somehow raise the risk of depression? And at this point, I can't tell you the answer, but again, identifying depression, treating depression, people are often amazed that, yes, indeed, they do turn out to be depressed. And I had one patient where I was asking her questions about depression. It's something I always try to screen for as part of an initial evaluation. She said, no, I'm not depressed. And I finally pulled up a very simple test on the computer, and we give the reference in the back of the book for where you can locate this yourself if it's a concern for you, and had her take the test with me, and then you click analyze, and sure enough, she was very surprised, but it was somehow vindicating for her to see, yes, indeed, I do have depression. And when that's treated, it doesn't make the pain go away, of course, it doesn't cure the migraines, but it certainly easier to deal with all these other complicated issues if you're not depressed at the same time.
Yeah. One of the myths that you write about in The Migraine Brain is that people with migraines have a low pain tolerance. And in fact, you say studies show that people with migraine develop high pain tolerance. So let's talk about how migraine affects people. On the very first page of the book, page one, you offer readers the stories of three people who have experienced the excruciating pain of migraine: Melissa, Terry, and Gwen. Can you give us some sense of what it is that people with migraine are going through for those of us who have never experienced it?
You know, people describe the pain in all kinds of different ways, and the images that they describe are so vivid. I have been keeping a collection of them because they're really just amazing. But the drill going through my head, the belt snapped around my forehead, the spikes, the dagger, these dramatic, violent images of something going on with the person's head, with the person's brain. And I think that when people live in this state of chronic pain, eventually they become accustomed to it. And something that, for a person who's never had a migraine experiencing one, it would be just the most awful pain. People walking around frequently with these kinds of headaches, it's very sad. They get used to it, and they actually seem to have a higher pain tolerance than people who don't experience these headaches.
Has migraine always been with human beings, and is it increasing?
Well, we cite some really interesting historical references. Migraine certainly has been described for thousands of years in ancient Greek records, literature. There are descriptions of headaches that were clearly migraines. I think that there's a problem with people using the term incorrectly, and so a lot of people who just get an occasional bad headache will say it's a migraine. And I think that people often use the term migraine as symbolic of this is a terrible headache, but actually you have to meet certain diagnostic criteria that we talk about in the book. And that's really important because if you're having a different kind of headache, even if it's a bad one, it's not going to respond to a treatment that's really geared for someone with migraine. I think that as awareness increases and younger doctors are taught now the correct diagnostic criteria for migraines, the diagnosis is increasing and the correct diagnosis is increasing. And that's a very good thing because it means that people can be treated properly. So I'm not sure that the actual frequency of the migraines is increasing, but I think the correct diagnosis is definitely increasing.
Okay, well, let's talk now about what is migraine and how it is diagnosed.
Well, migraine is a chemical cascade that takes place inside your brain. And so there's a lot of very interesting research now that's in process, and we certainly have some results that we discuss in the book that are available to people if they're interested. Migraine is a result of cells in a person's brain that are, if you think of it as kind of unstable, that tend to discharge, that tend to get excited when somebody who doesn't have migraines, the cells in their brain probably would not. And everybody's triggers, everybody's signals that excite those unstable cells is different. So for you, let's say it may be if you miss a night of sleep, that might trigger a migraine. For me, it might be if I had a glass of red wine, that might trigger a migraine. So it really varies tremendously. Once the cells get excited, they send almost a wave. Sometimes I use the description of a chain of dominoes. If you ever stacked those up when you were a kid and gave the end one a push and they all began to fall down in a chain, something like that, spreading through the brain and as the impulse, as the electrical impulse spreads, it can trigger off the nausea and vomiting center of the brain. It can trigger off parts of the brain that may control vision or sensation for some people who have certain subtypes of migraine. And then it loops down into the lower part of the brain and triggers off a nerve that controls pain on one side of the head or the other. And that's really what gets it going. We know that associated with migraine as part of this chemical cascade, people often will develop something called gastroparesis. And what that means is that their gut basically stops absorbing, which is why some of the older drugs for migraines that were pills that you took, they just didn't work because your body's ability to absorb them was impaired. So that's a really interesting piece and has affected the kinds of medications that we can offer people and the kinds of treatments. But it's a whole series of different events. And for some people, interestingly, the pain of the headache may not be the worst part. It may be the nausea, which is just so awful, or vomiting. Some people develop visual symptoms and never actually get the headache. And that can be really disabling for people who, let's say, are driving a car or who are reading something or teaching or whatever they may be doing. All of a sudden, they may lose part of their vision, have dark spots in their vision, all kinds of different things. So it really is important to be diagnosed correctly. In terms of, you asked me how do you make the diagnosis? Well, you have to have certain characteristics that fit together. The pain of the headache has to be of a certain quality. You have to have had a number of events, not just one, but a series of them, and they have to last a certain amount of time. If you think that you may be having migraines, what I would suggest that people do is write down as many things about the headache as they remember. You know, it started at X time, it didn't end until X time, this is what accompanied it, this is what I was doing before it started, maybe even this is what I was eating before it started, because there are certain kinds of foods that may trigger migraines. And take that information to your doctor, and if he or she can't help you sort it out, your primary care provider may be able to refer you to a neurologist or to a headache specialist who can help you get a diagnosis and put together a treatment plan. Mm.
Are there many, given all the work that's now being done in brain science, are there a good number of headache specialists out there?
I think there are some. I don't think it's a huge specialty. I can't tell you the exact number at this time. And I think that like many kind of subspecialty areas, probably access to those providers is clustered in bigger cities. Mm-hmm. And part of what really motivated me to write this book was the hope that somebody who may not be able to get to a headache center could find something in it that's really helpful and either make some changes on his own or her own, or maybe take it to their primary care provider and say, look, I think I have migraines. Here's why. And, you know, I'm interested in working through this with you. So I hope that it's at least a little bit empowering for people who may never actually be able to get to a headache center. Mm.
Dr. Carolyn Bernstein is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's a neurologist. She is also co-author of The Migraine Brain, Your Breakthrough Guide to Fewer Headaches, Better Health. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us with questions, comments, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Maybe you listeners have had experience with migraine. We'd like to hear from you this afternoon. Migraine often comes in stages. Would you give us a bit of an overview of the stages and what's going on?
Sure, I'd be glad to. For a lot of people, there's a prodrome phase, and that's the phase that kind of lets you know that the migraine is about to start. Not everybody has this. Not everybody has any of these things in sequence, but good to recognize them all. And with that prodrome phase, people describe some mood changes. They feel irritable. They feel edgy. They know something's about to happen. Some people have food cravings. Some people will start to yawn a lot. So it does vary quite a bit from person to person. The second phase that may or may not happen, and whether or not it does, depends on the type of migraine that you actually have, is called the aura. And with that phase, people will sometimes have those visual changes, which can be quite frightening the first time. So they may see sparkles, which are called scintillations. They may develop a black spot in the middle of their vision, which is called a scotoma. Some people will develop tingling on one half of their body or the other, or they may have trouble even getting words out. Recently, I was seeing a Harvard professor who had a migraine that began that way that really frightened him. All of a sudden, he was having a lot of trouble speaking to his class, and so it was, you know, exceedingly difficult. Mm. The next phase is the actual phase with the headache, the nausea, the vomiting, and that's the part when you just feel like you have got to go to bed unless you have a treatment plan, an abortive plan that will work pretty quickly. And then the last phase is a kind of post-drome phase, and I can tell you both clinically and from personal experience, that's almost a recovery period is what it feels like to me. It's the migraine's gone, but you still feel tired and dragged out like you've just been through some kind of experience. Some people describe feeling really happy, almost euphoric. But I think for most people, it's really that phase of fatigue, exhaustion, and relief that they're done with the migraine. So there really are these four different phases.
Why is there so much variation?
I think that migraine, as we know now, is almost certainly genetic. And indeed, for a couple of subtypes of migraine, the genetic site, the mutation, has actually been mapped out. And I think it depends on how your own body, how your own genetic makeup is describing the migraines to your brain. So it can vary a lot from person to person. Most people will have the headache, but then there are a whole subtype of these people who actually do just have the migraine equivalents, and those are, as you can imagine, hard to diagnose. You have to be, with any of these, 100% sure that there's nothing else going on. But I think that most people will have at least one or two parts of this that are pretty classic that enable their primary care provider, headache doctor, to be able to actually make the diagnosis correctly.
Mm. Let's take a call now from a listener in Champaign. Line one, you're on the air with Dr. Carolyn Bernstein.
Yes, I have a curious situation or question to ask you. I never suffered from migraine, but my mother did. And she told me a story which always amused me, and I never could get to the bottom of it. She said that when she was in her 20s, she had serious migraines. But that, then she said, well, but I got rid of it. Hmm. And I said, well, wait a minute, how did you get rid of it? She said, well, it's psychological. It's mind over matter. And whenever the word migraine was mentioned, she just would always say, well, it's mind over matter. That's the way she put it. She said, you've got to talk yourself out of it. And I was always suspicious of that. It seemed pretty preposterous to be medical judgment. I thought maybe it's something that you could outgrow with a period of time or something like that. But her own personal judgment on it was this mind over matter thing. And I've always had that as a curious question, and since you're an expert, I wonder what you think of that judgment.
Well, I'm glad that your mother was able to get beyond the migraines. There's no scientific data that you can talk yourself out of them. A lot of the time for women, they will really peak in terms of the frequency of their migraines in their 20s. A lot of women's migraines and the frequency of migraine in women is probably hormonal, so it's related to changes in their hormones. And as things kind of quiet down and women get older, get closer to menopause, oftentimes the migraines will disappear. In the book, we really make the point that you can't cure them, but sometimes they do disappear. They do go away, and they're not a lifetime problem, or they'll get less and less frequent. Maybe here's an idea. Your mom was actually doing some kind of what's called biofeedback with herself. She was doing some sort of relaxation technique, which even though you can't stop the migraine that way, you can adjust your body's pain responses by learning certain kinds of techniques, breathing, relaxation. You can learn how to change the temperature in your hands. Interestingly, hands of people with migraines often will get very cold when they have a headache, and you can do some mind-body exercises to learn how to warm up your hands. So she may have just been able to do something like that. But my guess, since, of course, I didn't know your mom, was that she was a person who really was in that kind of, I'm going to soldier through, I'm not going to give in to the migraines. And when Celeste was asking me before about how the misconception has been around that migraine patients have a low pain threshold. I actually think they really have a very high pain threshold, and there's good data to support that. And your mom may have just decided that she, you know, wasn't going to talk about it, wasn't going to discuss it. But, you know, when you have migraines, there's not a whole lot you can do to make them go away.
Interesting. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. Let's take another call. A listener in Mattoon on line four. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
A couple of years ago, I experienced what you were describing earlier, the aura, with the sparkle and the shimmering and all that. And it started out on the right side of my face and or my eyes, rather. And both eyes had it. I could close my eyes and still see it. And it would gradually move and get larger as it moved across to the left, from right to left. And I thought maybe it was, what do you call it, a little TMI or something, and took a couple aspirin, and with about 20 minutes they went away. And they occurred, just once every few weeks. And my eye doctor told me it was a migraine. And not to be all that concerned, because I hardly ever experienced it. So the next time it occurs, and it does occur every few months, instead of taking an aspirin, I just relax and sit down, lay down, and it gradually goes across from right to left and disappears. And I just wondered, is that, at first I thought maybe I was going to get a stroke, but I'm just wondering, is there anything I should do, or is it just something that I'm going to live with?
Well, I think you were really wise to go and see an eye doctor when that happened, because you're exactly right. That can be a kind of a warning sign of a stroke. A TIA is one term for that. That means temporary ischemic attack, and it means that the blood flow isn't getting through properly, and then later it does, and it resolves. And another term I think that you were using was TMB, which is transient monocular blindness, which is a little bit different, but is also a warning sign of a stroke. What you describe, I've heard the same story over and over from patients, and some people do, as I mentioned before, just get the visual symptoms, but they never actually get the headache. The more times it happens in the same way, the more reassuring that is, because you're familiar with it and it's not so frightening when it's happened a number of times before. There probably is not a way to get rid of it altogether, but it may just disappear over time. And I think the smart thing to do, you know, when you feel it about to start, is just to sit down, as you said, and now you probably have a sense of how long it's going to last. And if anything happens that's different or that's changing, that's when you call your physician or you go to the emergency room. But if it happens in the same way as you've described to us, you know, I think that it is just a migraine equivalent, or sometimes people call these ophthalmic migraines or optic migraines. Although it's scary, you know what it is and that it's not going to go anywhere.
Well, it kind of worried me, but then when I mentioned that there was never any pain, it was just a visual thing. So, but I didn't know whether I would take the aspirin, or would you think I would take a couple aspirin each time, or one, or just normally I take one baby aspirin every day in the morning.
I think I can't really give you any medical advice over the radio like this, but you know, I would certainly check in with your doctor, and there are a lot of recommendations in terms of who needs to be taking a daily aspirin every day, regardless. But
my doctor suggested I take. He put me on that baby aspirin every day, one. Time ago.
Yep, your doctor sounds like he gave you good advice.
Okay, so. It's something that if it starts being more frequent, or there's change, you think I should see a neurologist? Is that what you're saying? Or
I think for you and for anybody, if you have a pattern of the migraines or these migraine equivalents, if you will, whatever it may be, that suddenly starts to change, that's when you need to check it out with your own physician.
But usually they never last over 10 or 20 minutes.
Well, thanks for telling us about that, because that's a good thing for people to, you know, certainly to be aware about.
Okay. Is there any other advice?
Well, keep listening.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Dr. Carolyn Bernstein is our guest. She's an assistant professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School and a staff neurologist at Cambridge Health Alliance in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She's also the founder and director of the Women's Headache Center at Cambridge Health Alliance, which opened in 2006. She is the co-author with journalist Elaine McArdle of The Migraine Brain, Your Breakthrough Guide to Fewer Headaches, Better Health. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Are certain, you mentioned genetics and family history, but are there certain demographic groups at higher risk?
You know, migraines can really span all different demographic groups, and I think one thing to remember is that it may be skewed a little bit by who can actually get to a headache doctor or primary care provider who can make that diagnosis. But, you know, in terms of demographics, you see migraines just about down the line, which is interesting. They are more common in women than men, probably by about a 3-to-1 ratio. And that, I think, as I mentioned a minute ago, is probably related to hormonal changes that women experience as they go through having their period and then later on going through menopause, when the migraines oftentimes will tend to quiet down.
Mm. And children are also sufferers from migraine. And boys get more migraines than girls until the onset of puberty. This also suggests a hormonal kind of thing going on with the brain's chemistry.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Again, really important for kids because there are a lot of different things that they can do. And I think it's key for parents to think about if your child says, I have frequent stomach aches or I have frequent headaches, because there is a pediatric form of migraine that's really just the abdominal pain. Abdominal migraines would be one name that people use to describe that. But really important to make sure that you do get a diagnosis and that you don't just think it's your kid trying to get out of school, because these can be quite disabling for children. And as I mentioned, there are different kinds of treatments available, not necessarily all medications. So a lot of parents, understandably, don't want their kids to be using any medicines unless they absolutely have to. And I really support that and think that's very important. But there are other things that children can do to help them feel better.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more specifically about treatment here before we're out of time. But let's take another call now. A listener in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Yeah. I tuned in late, and you may have answered this question, but I have had sudden, you know, almost like comic strip lightning strikes across my eyes, flashing, no pain, no nothing, just the flashing. And when I consulted my eye doctor, he said, oh, that's migraine. But I've never had any pain with it, and it's only been infrequent. What does that mean?
Well, again, you know, I want to be a little careful about giving medical advice since I'm not seeing you as a patient, but what you're describing to me does sound a little bit like the gentleman a few minutes ago who was just having the visual symptoms without the migraines. And another term for what it sounds like you may be experiencing is migraine equivalence. So you're getting some of the transient, reversible phenomena that go along with the migraine without actually developing the headache. And again, you did exactly right by getting it checked out. That's not the kind of thing you want to just sit on at home and hope it's going to go away. You want to make sure there's nothing else going on. But these can often be very frightening when they happen, and people are waiting for a headache, especially when somebody uses the term migraine. And it's very important to get the right diagnosis and understand that you're not actually having a stroke, you're not having a heart attack, but you are having this transient episodic migraine type of occurrence in your brain.
I want to thank the listener for his call. Next, we go to line two. Listener in Champaign, hi.
Hi. I have a strange head thing that happens every few months. I'll get just this jabbing pain. It's like an ice pick that goes through my outer ear and straight into my head, and it only lasts a few seconds, and then it's gone, but it repeats like every, every 60 seconds. It'll do that for 3 seconds, for maybe several hours or till I take something or go to sleep. It's extremely painful, but just for those 3 seconds.
There are so many different kinds of headaches described by the headache classification group, and one kind that's really interesting is called jab and jolt headaches, and they're not actually migraines. They're brief, sharp, lancinating pains. Lancinating means it's like a dagger or a sword that just will occur very frequently, very quickly, and then go away, and it is a different kind of headache. So, you know, that may be one possibility. What you're describing doesn't sound like a migraine to me, but many different headaches, whether they're migraines or not, there are treatments available, and they can certainly be really incapacitating for people.
Jab and jolt. I'll see what I can find out about that.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Next, we take a call from a listener in Sydney on line one. Hi.
Hi. I have two questions, really. I wonder if you're familiar with a situation where the head becomes unusually and uncomfortably warm or almost hot. And this doesn't involve a fever. And two, what do you think about Topamax for treating migraines?
Well, in response to your first point, people do develop all kinds of autonomic dysfunction when they have migraines. And so by that, it can include all the kind of baseline regulatory functions of the body. So some people will feel really hot. As I mentioned a minute ago, some people will get really cold hands. Some people will develop changes in their blood pressure, may go up a little bit with the migraine. Usually one of the things that can be really, really helpful for people with migraine when the pain starts or that feeling of heat begins is to put ice on their head. And what I tell people is if you're at work and you can't walk around with an ice bag on your head, get one of those gel packs, keep it in the freezer at work, and just pop it around your neck almost as though you have a sore neck, and the cold will travel up over your scalp, and that may make you feel a lot better. Another idea is to, if you're not nauseous, is to try to drink something with ice in it, drink something cold. So that can be really helpful. But people do indeed describe those feelings of just incredible heat at the onset of a migraine. In terms of Topamax, which is a seizure drug called topiramate, it has an approved FDA indication for migraine treatment. And for a lot of people, it's very, very helpful, even at a low dose. But, you know, people sometimes will say to me in the office, does this drug have side effects? And the answer to that is every single medicine, including Tylenol, has potential side effects. So it's a decision that you really need to make with your healthcare provider individually. For some people, it can be a great choice. It can really cut down on both the frequency and the intensity of migraines.
Side effects of a low dose of Topamax?
Well, you know, hopefully whoever would be prescribing this medication to you would go through the side effects with you. But one thing that's really important is that people who are allergic to sulfa drugs may have some cross-reactivity with this medicine. It can cause appetite suppression. Some people lose a lot of weight to a point where it can really be dangerous for them to continue on the medicine. It can cause kidney stones and some other problems. Complications are rare with it, but again, it's a very individualized decision, and if you have questions, you know, make sure that you do either ask your physician or that you ask the pharmacist to give you a list of potential side effects.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Next, we take a call from a listener in Urbana, line 3. Good afternoon.
Oh, hello, ma'am.
Hi.
I used to have this migraine. My primary physician told me that this is a typical migraine, but I just wanted to have an opinion from you. What do you think about that? So, you know, this starts like a kind of a blurry vision. It starts from either one of my eyes, and then the blurry vision is like, you know, kind of a wrinkles and some kind of wave forms of objects, you know, it's just lines which is going around, and then slowly that blurs my vision. And I know that when that starts and when it lasts a specific time, opposite side of my head on that, whatever the side comes from, the blurry vision comes from, the opposite side, I will have the pain. And I learned this, and then because it takes time to get the pain when I have that vision. So what I did is, and also I want to tell you, the longer the blurry vision is, the proportionately, it is proportionately equal to the intensity of the pain, what I would be getting. And then what I thought is, as soon as I get the blurry vision, I used to take the painkiller so that I will get that excruciating pain within minutes. So it was there for some like 20 years, and then I now wearing a glass from my optician who suggested for astigmatism. But after like last 6-7 years, I considerably decreased that event by just slightly changing my diet, because I figured out most those days I have never took my breakfast, and I took 2 coffees in that morning. I used to never skip my breakfast and take a straight lunch. But now I figured out, you know, because of the excess of caffeine might be leading to, in the empty stomach, might be leading to that. So I significantly reduced the coffee, and then I make sure I eat breakfast in the morning, and then now I do not have that kind of migraines any longer. So I think if anybody could change the caffeine intake and the drinks and the food what they eat and make the stomach doesn't have acidity, probably that might help a bit. And I will thank you for you, and I'll look forward to your comment, and I will stop and listen. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call this afternoon. Nice point he raises here, Dr. Bernstein.
Yeah, he really does. You know, I think it's terrific that you were so thoughtful about what might be triggers for you and made these changes. And again, in our book, The Migraine Brain, we really stress that when you have migraines, you have to be so hypervigilant about your own care and really take good care of yourself. So for a lot of people, skipping a meal can trigger off a migraine. So important to make sure that you eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It doesn't have to be a lot, but something healthy with some protein, and that you have some good snacks during the day, and make a point of remaining hydrated, really drinking a lot of water, not letting yourself get challenged or dehydrated in any way. And I think that for many people who can pay attention to that and be meticulous about it, as this gentleman did, you can really reduce both the frequency and the intensity of your migraines. So look at what's going on as carefully as you can and see if you can find any specific triggers for you that you can adjust and work with.
Let's take another call now. A listener in Mattoon, line 4. Hi.
Thank you. This is in connection with what the man just said about, I think it was. I had to turn my radio down. But anyway, I never had a headache in my life until the early 60s, which was 20 years ago. And then I began having what was diagnosed as migraines, the very, very, very painful, and lots of flashing lights occasionally, that kind of thing, lasted 24 hours or more. This went on for several months, and we tried all the drugs that were available at the time, and they just made me feel worse. I couldn't tolerate them, apparently. But at any rate, through a family member who's a physician, I found out about coffee. I take in no caffeine in my system. That is, I just never cared for coffee, nor colon or anything like that. And if you are caffeine free, according to this, whatever it is, a cup of coffee in the morning will keep you from having migraines, and it does me.
Well, I think that's again terrific that you figured that out, and I will share with everyone listening that caffeine is in a lot of over-the-counter migraine medications and,
yes,
and headache medications, and
yes,
it is probably the cheapest and most effective, readily available way to treat a migraine that exists. And it's a very old treatment.
Yes, well, it does the trick for me. And if I've tried to skip, I've thought, oh, I'm all right. I don't need that anymore. Well, I do.
Well, the problem I was going going to mention this. The problem with caffeine is that you can set yourself up for a caffeine withdrawal headache that for migraine sufferers may actually trigger off a migraine. And so if you're a coffee drinker and you enjoy it and it feels good, or you like to have a cup in the morning, you have to do it consistently or you may get a withdrawal headache. But I think as long as you have a cup or two a day and you don't go overboard with it, I think that's fine. And for a lot of people, that really keeps them from developing migraines when they wake up in the morning. So I think it is a myth that if you have migraines, you have to rigorously and meticulously avoid caffeine. Just be careful about it. Be mindful about it.
Well, one cup a day I don't think is going to kill anybody.
No, I agree.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Also, one of the myths surrounding migraine triggers, chocolate.
Chocolate's definitely another myth. Again, individualized, so there may be a person who every time he or she eats chocolate develops a migraine, but for most people that just isn't true. And people are missing out on a treat that tastes good, that raises the chemical in the brain called serotonin, that makes people feel better, feel happy, and that a little bit of dark chocolate in reasonable or small quantities may actually be good for your heart and good for your blood vessels. So what I would ask people to do who think that chocolate is a migraine trigger is do a test. Try eating a little piece of dark chocolate or milk chocolate, you know, whichever one you prefer, and then see what happens after that. And if you've been avoiding it all your life because you think it's going to make you have a migraine, you may be pleasantly surprised. So just another piece of data to support the idea that it is very individualized and people really vary one from the next.
Okay. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
You are the perfect person to answer my question. I have had migraines for 30 years, first one in my 20s. The first 20 years, they were classic migraines. And the last 10, they've just been the ocular migraines. But throughout the period, I have the full complement of vision disturbance, speech disturbance, numbness or tingling in one hand. And I have often wondered if somebody like me with those, they've been described as vascular spasms, I don't know if that's really what's going on, but does it make me any more likely to be a candidate for stroke?
You know, that's an area where a lot of research is being focused at this point, and there is some data to support the idea that people who have these focal neurologic changes, so numbness on one side, the visual changes, difficulty with language, with word finding, may be at a slightly increased risk. The thing to remember is there's not a whole lot that you can change about that. So in other words, you can't get rid of that. And it is, you know, a probably small, small increased risk. But what that tells me as a physician about a person like you is that I would want you to be so careful to make sure that you have healthy blood pressure, that your cholesterol is at a good range, that you don't smoke, that you are meticulous about doing exercise on a frequent basis. So in other words, that you really keep yourself in good shape and that you minimize your stroke risk factors. Because even though there probably is an associated slightly increased risk, you can modify your risk factors for both stroke and heart disease by paying attention to these things.
Okay, thank you.
You're very welcome. We have to wrap up now, and I've got one last caller. I'm sorry, we just can't squeeze that listener in this afternoon. But here to wrap up, Dr. Bernstein, say a word or two about complementary and alternative treatments, and how effective are they, and when do you put them into gear?
One question that I ask each new patient that I see in the Women's Headache Center is, what had you thought about treatment? Are you a person who is interested in medications, or are you a person who really doesn't want to do that? And if that woman says, you know, I don't want to take any drugs, then I'm not going to recommend any to her unless I think that it's absolutely medically necessary for some reason. I think that there are non-drug treatments, what we call complementary treatments or integrative therapies, that are excellent, that can make a huge difference for which, again, there is data, there is research to support that they can be really effective. And that's important to me because I want people to do things, obviously, that are safe, and I also want them to invest their energy and also sometimes their money, because a lot of these things are not covered by health plans at this point. I want them to invest their money and their energy in things that I think are really likely to make a difference. So I may recommend yoga treatments for a person, working on specific poses that may decrease migraine frequency. There are some poses, such as what's called child's pose, that can feel very good to rest in that pose if you do have a really bad migraine. I may recommend acupuncture or biofeedback, which we talked about earlier, meditation treatments for some people. There's a wide range of different possibilities. Some people feel a lot better with massage, especially if they have a lot of stiffness and tightness in their neck that's related to the migraine.
Yeah. There I've got to jump in. My apologies, but we're just out of time. Dr. Bernstein, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for all the calls as well.
Dr. Carolyn Bernstein is the author of The Migraine Brain. She's the co-author with Elaine McArdle, Your Breakthrough Guide to Fewer Headaches, Better Health. It's relatively new out in the bookstores, but I would imagine that it will be coming in a few months out in paperback. The book is published by the Free Press, and we had a request that I spell our guest's name. So Carolyn is spelled with a Y, and Bernstein is Bernstein. Carolyn Bernstein, co-author of The Migraine Brain. The book is published by the Free Press.